Welcome to the HCI family of podcasts. We're your source for personal, professional, and organizational growth and development. We share our own original research, explore industry trends, and interview executives and thought leaders from across the globe. Join us for practitioner-oriented content around all things leadership, HR, talent management, organizational development, and change management. Maximize your personal and organizational potential with the HCI family of podcasts.
Thomas Ng, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, John.
It is a pleasure to be with you. You're sitting here in my office at Utah Valley University, along with Dr. Angela Schill, who will be co-hosting with me today. Thomas is a world traveler and has been on the road for quite a while and is joining us with his wife, who is not going to join the conversation, but is going to listen and maybe correct her husband from time to time, depending on how it goes. Real pleasure to be with you. Today, we're going to be talking about empowering marginalized communities through social entrepreneurship endeavors, and you're a great person to have this conversation with. As we get started, I wanted to share Thomas's bio with everybody. Thomas Ng is founder of Genashtum, a for-profit social enterprise that aims to empower marginalized communities through specialization in e-learning, digitalization, and ESG services. His remarkable journey began in 2008, when he embarked on a mission to provide meaningful employment opportunities for the disadvantaged. Through Genashtum, he has empowered individuals across 25 countries, from people with disabilities to refugees and older adults, by pioneering a 100% remote work environment. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of Thomas's background. We're going to explore more of his background today. Thomas, before we dive on into the conversation, anything you would like to share or highlight? And then we'll just...
No, I think as we go along, perhaps do some flashbacks, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, thank you, Angela, for joining me. Always a pleasure.
Happy to be here. Thank you, John.
Maybe the first question, if you could tell us a little bit about Genashtum and a little bit of the origin story of how you moved from more of the corporate executive lifestyle and career towards getting out of that rat race and moving into the social entrepreneurship realm.
Okay, so I had a pretty good corporate career for 25 years, and the last 15 years of that, I was, in those days, it was quite a big thing to be an expatriate in Asia, so I was one of the very first Asian expatriates, you know. And of course, as an expatriate, in those days, you do lead a rather decadent lifestyle, you know, belong to the clubs and all this kind of stuff. And but after 15 years, I found that corporate life was not for me. Just felt that couldn't find a real sense of purpose, and didn't really like some of the things I was asked to do. So I actually had no intention of going into social entrepreneurship. For me, it was just that I was spending so much time at work and traveling so much, I didn't spend enough time with family. So I thought I would just maybe take a few years off and spend some time at home. Family had moved to Melbourne. The kids were studying in school there. And I was in Manila working. I mean, it's a kind of a, it doesn't really make sense. So, but in big companies, with senior executives, there's such a thing as the garden leave clause in your contract. So when I resigned, they activated that garden leave, which I didn't even know was there. That clause, and basically they paid me for a year. I had to stay put, and just in case they needed me for something. But mostly it was to stop me from working for other competitors or other companies. I tried to get out of it. I said, I'll sign any document, you know, to say that I would not work at all. Just I was even going to say, I'll just not work with anybody. But they wouldn't agree. So I ended up still spending quite a bit of time in Manila. They paid for my house, my car, my driver, the whole works. I could travel in and out. But so during the time when I was a working executive there, I get a lot of invitations to join NGO boards. And I always say I have no time, and actually do. I didn't have any time. But so that year, I had no excuse. So I was quite intrigued because some of my fellow CEO friends had sitting on the board of this computer school for the blind. And I thought, blind people use the computer, never come across. So I attended the first board meeting that time before, you know, I confirmed the appointment. So they did a bit of selling job, and it was this blind guy giving a PowerPoint presentation which had music incorporated in the PowerPoint presentation. And I said, "This is very good." I said, "So who did this for you?" And they said, "No, I did it myself." And I said, "Hang on just a minute, I don't believe you, you know." So he challenged me to look for something on the internet. We had a third person say, "Okay, look for this," and then, you know, we put it. And he did three tries and he beat me every time. So kind of convinced me that, hey, these people can actually do this. So I said to the board, I asked the board, I said, "So how many people have you trained and how many are working where?" You know, so at that time, 2007 it was, no, 2005 it was actually, they had trained 500 blind people to use the computer over 5 years. But none of them were actually in any meaningful gainful employment. So most of them just went back to the provinces and just went about life the same as before, except they could now go onto Facebook. So that was a big achievement. So I made it my role. I said, "Hang on, these people should be working, you know." And so I said, "I'm going to make my board position the one for employment." So I took these graduates to various companies who the CEOs are my good friends, and of course they'll always be as impressed as I was, calling all their vice presidents and said, "We have to do something for these people." And but it's always, "Oh, you have strategic planning exercise coming up, let's do this in 2 months' time." Then it was budget, then it was this, and it was that, and it was some crisis, and it was always, and then, "Oh, our HR person just left and wait for a new one to come in," and the new one came in, give him a 2 months to get into the job. So it was, so after 2.5 years, how many people I managed to place in the employment? Zero. So at that point, I said, "Okay, I'm not going to spend any more time doing this." So I said, but I was totally convinced as I got to know them better, I said, they can actually work. And then, of course, when you look, I was at that time only trying to promote it for the blind, but then I got to know also the other people, other disabilities and all that. So I said, "Okay, we're going to start a company." So it's a classic thing that you start a company without knowing what you're going to do, you know. Oh, you know, say, "I'm going to employ these people, they can work." So what are we going to do? We came to the realization is that hiring a person with disability in Manila, you know, normal people take 2 to 3 hours to commute to work each way. So for a person with disability, it was just impossible. He might have to start coming the day before, you know, to arrive at the office in the morning. And probably he'll be, you know, rock blind, I mean, by the time he got to the office. So then it's okay, we have to have a 100% remote work model. You know, so we said, okay, fine. And it was tough because in those days, the internet wasn't what it is today, especially in the Philippines. So a bit of a struggle, we somehow kind of managed it. And then the next step was, so, okay, we know that we're going to hire people with from the marginalized communities and they can work online. And what are you going to do? You know, so, okay, then said, well, you can do programming, web development, you can do this, you can do that. We stumbled into e-learning. Thought, oh, this is a very interesting thing. Way too early. I mean, 7-8 years, probably too early, but never mind. We represented a company who was selling an online MBA program. And so we did our own English training online. And it was just very tough because the market just wasn't there. So we kind of, struggled for, I would say, more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I'll stop there because, you know, that's how I actually got into the game.
That's wonderful. And if we can go back just a little bit. So you mentioned in the corporate world, you're in these executive roles, you're living a posh lifestyle, being an expat in these different countries. And you make the decision that this isn't for you. You're not spending enough time with your family. You want to, you're not feeling meaning, purpose. You're being asked to do things that maybe you don't agree with, that you're uncomfortable with. I think anyone listening who finds themselves in a big organization can probably relate to all of those sentiments. And it's always this tension, I think, that we all feel. I mean, even here at UVU, we're 45,000 students. I don't know how many thousands of employees. It's a big organization. And I love this place. And I love the faculty I work with. I love the students. I love the programs I'm involved with. But any organization, you're going to have things that frustrate you. Mm-hmm. You're even going to have the higher you go up into the leadership within an organization, oftentimes the more often you're asked to even compromise a little bit of your ethics or your integrity, your personal integrity.
Yeah.
And that's hard to be able to navigate that. Can you zoom in and speak to that a little bit more about like what that tension you were feeling, what you were experiencing at the time, and why you took the drastic step to resign? You know, 25 years of great experience. Mm-hmm. You're clearly a needed, valued administrator and executive. You have lots of success. It must have been pretty dramatic at that point in time, to the extent you're comfortable sharing. Like, what was going on at that point to push you towards, I'm going to be done for a while. I'm going to step aside.
So, of course, there are many things. Let me see. I try to be diplomatic here. So, I'll just touch on two. One is that people, I mean, you become a leader in an organization. You get to know your people and you tell them certain things and you know, say, this is how a relationship is going to be and all that. But then in the corporate world, you don't have control on execution. So next year, they may come up with a new plan and say, this is the way we run this HR program. And then, you know, suddenly you tell people, well, actually, you don't know what to tell them anymore. You know? So that was very, very difficult. And then every year, we'd have the top management. This was a European company. So they go off into a deer hunting country or something like that. And stay in a lot somewhere, and in the evening they'll be drinking their vodka and then talking about the organization. So they come back, you know, in September, and then we have a new organization restructuring implemented every year.
Oh boy.
And then we print new name cards, reorganize people into different boxes, move tables around in the office and everything. And for me, it's like, they haven't changed the business. And then you go to clients. The worst thing is, you go to clients, is like, how do I describe it? It's like we're selling these tumblers, right? So with our client, blue tumblers, they are really very, very good. So we are making them all blue because the blue has this effect of calming and blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And then next year you go to the same customer, you make a red tumbler, and it's like, actually research shows that the red color actually, you know, increases your energy and this and that and everything. And then the next year will be a yellow tumbler and try to tell another story. And I couldn't face people telling them nonsense. I'm the local, I'm the country manager of a big multinational company. And how can I go and tell my customers? And my customers become my friends. Yeah. In fact, some of them remain my friends, you know, until today. You know, I've left the corporate world for decades. So I couldn't deal with that. I find that very difficult to deal with. And then what do you do every day? You're doing stuff for somebody in head office, and you know for a fact that what you're doing has no impact on the business, has no impact on the people, has no impact on your customer. You're doing it because somebody...
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was that was how I said, I just couldn't do this anymore. I just didn't feel good about myself.
No, I mean, that makes complete sense to me. And Angela, feel free to chime in, but I don't know. One of the reasons why I became a professor is because I just felt like I had to do something where I derived meaning and purpose and where I could see the impact of what I was doing, or at least trying to do. Going way back in time, I was an accounting major in university. And there's nothing wrong with accountants. We need good accountants. And I was good at it. And I was like, oh, this is a good program, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, I just came to this realization, thankfully early, that wasn't going to bring me meaning and purpose. I wasn't going to be satisfied in that kind of career. I would have done well. It would have been secure. I would have, lots of job security. I would have had, made a good living, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that's fine and well, and nothing against people who choose accounting.
Yeah.
But it wasn't for me. It just wasn't the right fit for me. And like you say, I could not find myself in a situation where I feel like on a daily basis, I have to check my own, kind of outsource my own morality and check it at the door, to say, people say it all the time. Well, yeah. I didn't have a choice. So-and-so told me to.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's not a good answer, in my opinion. You know, like if you don't think it's right, then you either don't do it, or you have the hard conversation with the person telling you to do the thing mm-hmm. and try to convince them and try to influence them, right? And there's only so much of that you can do before you feel like you're beating your head against a brick wall mm-hmm. and you feel like you have to do something different. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm hearing you yeah. say a little bit.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I resonate with that. Angela, anything you wanted to?
I know a little bit of this story, and I would like to hear, I'd like our audience to hear what that conversation was like with your wife, Jen, when you came to her and said, "I'm doing this pivot," and how she took that news. What happened?
That was easy because it happened in stages. So it kind of snuck up on her, right? Uh-huh. So the first thing was, "Honey, I'm going to spend all my time home with you and the kids." That was the first thing, right?
Yeah.
I said, I quit my job, right?
Yeah.
But at that time, I didn't even know myself that I had to hang around for another year. Mm-hmm. So they kind of said, well, I can't get out of it. It's a legal thing. Otherwise, they'll sue me. So I ended up studying a year. And then, of course, you know, then it kind of crept up on her. I don't think there was a point where I presented everything to her in
it
one go.
Clean
it was a slippery slope.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah. So, but... You know, I remember this very profound moment when, you know, I work so much and, you know, I made a lot of money. And basically, I'm not the investor type person. And and I basically had most of my salary was paid to a bank account in Switzerland. And I did nothing with it. It was just left.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I left corporate life, so, of course, and my friends would recommend, you know, fund managers and all that kind of stuff. They use my money sitting there, not doing anything and everything. So I did that just before the GFC.
Hmm.
So I was unlucky enough to be introduced to a rogue trader of sorts. And he kind of, you know, lost all my money. Well, anyway, most of it. And then I ended up with, you know, what we had left. And I sat down with her. I said, look, you know, this is no nest for anything. So I said, but I had this idea because that was after I attended the computer school, right?
Yeah.
Let's do this. I said, we're living in Australia. It's a very comfortable environment. We mm-hmm. have a house. We don't owe anybody any money.
Mm-hmm.
I said, worst comes to worst, if I lose it all, you know, we'll just go and work in the checkout counter of a supermarket and we'll live comfortably for the rest of our lives, you know? And then I said, I promise I won't touch the house, you know? And that was a profound moment because then she said, looked around, said to me, we can move to a smaller house. So the support was kind of, and I tell my employees all the time, I say, look, that without the support, can you imagine any wife allowing a husband to do something so insane? Right? The rest of their money, we just throw it away. And a bunch of people who have no qualification, never worked before, and you don't know most of them. And
That's an incredible amount of support
and faith in
your vision.
And then for 10 years, from an expat wife, you know how an expat wife lives?
It's different, I mean,
you
know, lifestyle.
Become the wife of a struggling social entrepreneur.
Yeah. So it's total change of
life.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. But I think it was very useful and it was good because now we suddenly now don't have that financial constraint anymore. And we just feel that we don't need a lot of things that we used to have, we actually found out we don't need anymore.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's quite easy for us to be happy and, you know, basically we don't take out much money from the company, although the company is doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
The employees get paid off several times more than we do, you know, so.
Wow.
So, but for us, we're very comfortable. I mean, we can fly here, you know, we can.
Yeah, but you didn't know how it would be at that
point. No,
in
fact,
was the big question mark.
Yeah. But we just felt that, at that time, we just felt that, look, I still am able to do this, I believe. I mean, that was 15 years ago. I'm young enough, and I think there is a potential here. But to be honest, if somebody had told me at that time, it would take you 12 years before you start seeing anything, probably wouldn't have started.
Yeah.
12 years is a long time, yeah.
And it doesn't quite reach the level of support that your wife exhibited.
Yeah.
But I just think back to like when I went, you know, a series of stages of going to my wife and saying, first, I want to change my major. First, I want to do this grad program. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I'm sure she got really tired of these conversations, you know, and the last time we had that conversation, I was graduating with my master's degree and we were ready to not be poor anymore, ready to like go get a nice corporate job. And you know, make money and blah, blah, blah. And we already had a kid. We had a second on the way. And I remember going, I was like in a third round interview with Honeywell. And great company.
Oh, yes.
It would have been a great opportunity. But I left that interview just with the realization, this isn't for me. And I walked home that night. And on the way home, I'm thinking, you know what? I think I want to do a PhD. And it had always been in the back of my mind, maybe someday. But I'm like, I think I just want to do this now. And I got home and I kind of dropped the bombshell on my wife because she was ready to be done with student housing and like all that. And not only did I want to do a PhD, but I wanted to do sociology. So not like business or something. Like I was going to do like, I could be putting us in a state where we're going to be poor our whole lives. and she was so supportive the whole time. And, you know, she supported me through that program. You know, six kids. She then did her own degree. She's now a professor here as well. But she did it in the non-traditional path. Anyways, like I just wanted to reiterate how helpful it is, how important it is to have great support from those you love.
Yes, absolutely. Otherwise, how could you couldn't do it. I mean, you can't go home and then, you know, the wife whining at you, why the hell do you do this? You know, and why can't I afford this anymore? Because you decided you want to do this. Yeah. But, you know, John, in your case, I mean, you're quite lucky to have found a good university to work for. Because I know I know a few professors, good friends who really complain about
it. It's not an easy thing to land a good position.
A good employer is something quite rare, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Something else I wanted to hone in on, your focus in your company on working with disadvantaged populations, particularly those with disabilities. I years ago, this was a long, long time ago, but I served an LDS mission in South Korea. So I lived for 2 years in Seoul, Incheon, that region of South Korea. And then upon finishing those 2 years, I came back, I went to university a bit, and then I went back and I worked in the Busan southern portion of South Korea for LG Electronics, a big company. And so I had that experience in Korea. And since then, I've been back to China many times. And I've lived in Australia and visited New Zealand and lived in Jakarta, you know, different places throughout Asia. And I know Angela's been all over too. Angela's been a world traveler also. I'm curious, from the disability standpoint, I know when my most intensive period was that 2 years that I was a missionary interacting with people in South Korea. And this was like 1998 to 2000. So this is a long time ago. A lot may have changed since then. But I know the attitudes around disabled communities was not particularly positive. Maybe to put it lightly. I'm wondering, like, what kind of social stigma and barriers have you faced as you're trying to employ people from those marginalized communities, people who are disabled, who people just assume they can't do this. They can't, you know, that's breaking through that stigma and that attitude, I imagine could be very difficult. Could you speak to that a little bit?
So, good question, because when we started the company in the first maybe 10 years or more, at least in the initial years, we were very, very careful in the sense that when we presented ourselves to a prospective client, we would never say that we are hiring people who are disadvantaged. We just say, this is our company, this is our employees, this is what we do, this is how we do. On our website, we have a tab from the very beginning called Beyond CSR. If anybody click on that tab, including photos, videos of employees, and they look, they're talking about their disability and everything is disclosed. I can tell you throughout, say, at least 10 years of talking to maybe 100, 200 companies, not one single person clicked on that tab. Because if they click on that tab, they probably comment and say, Thomas, is this true? And we did that because we were fearful that if we were to tell people that the work would be done by people, they would not trust us. They would not think that we are a proper company, some kind of an NGO, and we cannot expect quality
right.
service from you and all that. So we actually stayed away. In fact, I tell you, honestly speaking, until the first time that we got a project that the client knew that we were using people with disabilities to do the project was actually with Microsoft Southeast Asia, when Astrid was the head for external and legal affairs. And that was the first time that actually somebody came to us and said, I want to give you this work because...
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it wasn't until, I think, remember my corporate comm person came to me maybe 3 years ago and said, Thomas, isn't it about time that we, come out of the closet, yeah. so to speak, as far as this is concerned. And when he first asked me, I said, why do you want to bother with this? Let's focus on business. It's growing, we're doing well and everything. Kept pestering. And so, in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 years, we started to be a bit more open. That's what we do and all that. Because I felt there wouldn't be any repercussions because you're solidly kind of,
your work would speak for itself.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. But
have you faced repercussions?
No.
Or has it been a positive feedback or just neutral, would you say?
Of course, it has been positive. I mean, people were just amazed. And we had clients that came to us and gave us more work, actually. But this is in the more recent years, two or three years. I mean, I remember Singapore Business Federation, we were doing one program for them for training Singaporeans to become regional executives. And then they came to us and said, look, our foundation wants to run a CSR training for companies. And they said, we think your company is best suited. You know, they had proposals from 3 universities in Singapore.
Wow.
And they picked us instead. So it was kind of something else, right? They said, well, we feel that we want somebody who actually, walks the talk. A bunch of academics talk about it. So there was quite a feather in our cap. So, overall, it has been positive because we do a good job. We prove that we have done a good job. And even like B-Lab, for example, when they... Bart Holohan himself was motivated to give us the opportunity to try because they were also quite desperate. They didn't have resources to cope with the pipeline. But he knew that, that's what we stand for and all that. So, but, today we have one of our... top analyst, he's a Malaysian guy, Raj, right?
Yeah.
Paralyzed from the neck down, operates the computer by voice. And he's very fine companies in US, in Europe. So it's like way up there, And even then, we had one of the senior people come out to Asia just in March. And I invited him for dinner and brought some of them around. He's also the people with wheelchairs, crutches, blind people, And then he said that, Thomas, I've heard about this, but it's not something that sticks in the mind until I come here and I see it. And I said, this is real. So most people who hear about it just think, it's something they do. They probably have a token guy there who does it. And then, so, but our company is run by a management team who are. It's only one person apart from me. I consider myself senior. So in the disadvantaged group, 67 years old, if I apply for a job, nobody will give me a job, right?
Yeah.
So apart from me, there's only one person who is not in any of those. A bunch of disabled people, 2 are blind. We have a cancer survivor. We have, my HR manager has serious depression problems.
Mm.
He's on heavy medication.
See, and I've clicked on your tab.
Yeah.
That tab that it has all of the different testimonials.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've seen the internal newsletters that you've shared and support each other. Mm. There's a culture that you've developed within your...
Mm.
So I think when I think of your company, you can stand by your work. People can see the quality of what you're producing and the sheer amount is overwhelming.
Yeah.
And the different areas that you've been involved with, but also just seeing the supportive culture that you've created in it and not... There's no bricks and mortar.
Yeah,
you're
nothing.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
What was it?
Everywhere, nowhere.
But you've supported each other so deeply.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot. I read one of the articles about depression and how working from home helped them be able to cope with that. And I just think you've done a great job of supporting and creating a culture where there's support and then you're reaching out and doing humanitarian work in addition to that. That's which right. It blows my mind.
Actually, remote work does help because I've had a number of instances. People came to me and said, I was dealing with this guy, you know, for a year.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize he's blind.
Mm-hmm.
Or I didn't realize he's in a wheelchair because mm-hmm. I'm dealing with him online.
Right.
So until you meet the person in person, you wouldn't know. Right? So
yeah.
So in a way, it removes that potential for bias. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's nice to be able to get past the biases that
yeah.
people have,
right.
the stigma that might be associated with it. And the bottom line is, if I'm a client and I'm trying to work with a company,
mm-hmm.
I shouldn't really care
yeah.
who's doing the work or how they're doing the work as long as they do good work.
Yeah.
Right. And at the end of the day, you are doing great work. And that's why you're able to the clientele that you have and that you have return customers, et cetera. We get in our own way with our biases
yeah.
because we discount people that
yeah.
otherwise could be very capable just because in our minds, we can't conceive of how. Like, I can't imagine how I could be productive if I say I didn't have arms.
Mm.
But we know that there are people that have incredibly successful careers and productive lives
yeah, yeah.
when
yeah.
they have that kind of a disability. Or talk about, we've been talking about physical disabilities largely, but like neurodivergent individuals,
yeah.
right? Like there's so many different types of disabilities that maybe I don't fully understand. I'm a neurotypical person,
yeah, yeah.
but they can unlock all sorts of different things that I couldn't do. Like
mm.
they could be great at things that I couldn't be great at perhaps,
yeah.
or certainly they could be successful. And so just breaking down those mental barriers, I think that people have is really great. And even clients that you have that didn't know they had
mm-hmm.
disabled individuals working
yeah.
on their projects,
yeah.
but later find out,
yeah.
I imagine, you know, it's heartwarming.
Yeah.
You know, but people probably aren't going to hire you for the heartwarming story. But once they hear it, they're like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it can maintain a good relationship. Anyways, I think it's really, really cool. You had told the story earlier of, you know, hiring individuals who are blind. I think of one friend that I had all the way back into my college years. And we were like good friends for, I don't know, at least 6 months
mm.
or more before I knew he was legally blind. You know, he was an honor student.
But you're with him physically.
I'm physically in person with him.
Even then, you know.
And I did, he was so capable.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't like 100% blind, but he was
yeah.
legally blind.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had all sorts of accommodations that maybe mm. I was oblivious, but largely
mm.
he just was super capable, super
mm.
smart, super, super able to do anything he needed to do. And he'd
mm.
figure out how to do it. And that's amazing. Anyways, we shouldn't sell people short. Give people the opportunity
yeah.
to demonstrate what they can do.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things your company's doing that I think is just so tremendous.
And I think it's great that sometimes people might have those biases you're talking about, John. Then they meet you, they
mm.
meet people that work for you and know their stories
mm.
and it changes their, it diminishes those biases because suddenly they realize what they thought was true is not true. I love the story of, I think, is it Nadia that is your personal secretary?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I find out later, you can tell the story about, is it Nadia that, how she operates, how she's able to do her
yeah,
work.
Yeah, she is cerebral palsy patient.
Mm-hmm.
So she was disabled from the neck down, you know, from birth.
Yeah.
And she can move only the tip of her index finger on the right hand. She can't move the rest of that finger. She can't move her hand. She can only move the tip. So her mother would, you know, wash in the morning, everything, put her in front of the, in a wheelchair in front of her laptop, turn it on, and put her hand onto the mouse. And the mouse is upside down. Because the tip of the finger moves the mouse and pulls the mouse to click with one of the knuckles.
Yeah, that's incredible to me.
Yes, and she runs my life. I mean, checks my flights, you know,
yeah.
make sure that the hotel booking is right and then my schedules and this and that. So
well, I have community.
She can do that. And she's, actually when she speaks, you won't notice because she has a very strong voice.
Mm-hmm.
Nadia speaks a very strong voice and she's been working with me for more than 10 years.
See, and that taught me something,
mm-hmm.
working with you, working with Nadia,
arranging yeah.
things. And then finding out about her story, it's,
yeah.
to me, I thought, oh, I had some biases I didn't even know about until now.
Yeah.
And now they've been crushed because I can see what this woman
yeah.
is doing. And it's inspiring. And for you to be the kind of supportive employer that sees this, that's willing for 12 years to just wait for the company to blossom and bloom, and you didn't know COVID was coming or that I could be a good thing.
That's right, But the thing is, that I just feel that there should be more, you know, you watch this CNN Heroes, right? I mean, these people should be some kind of, you know, projected as some kind of inspiration. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they didn't do that. I mean, many of them, for example, we had the press interview some of us, you know, and when they published the article, it didn't really focus on the individual and how that person with such a, you know, coming from such a disadvantaged background with so many limitations can thrive. I mean, and I don't know that, I think somebody should start a series of, you know, showcasing such, you know, impressive. I still remember the first time I came to Denver. It was many years ago at the YPO conference. That time, my that was actually, Nadia was not even with me at that time. Yeah, it was Maricel. She's blind, Filipina. And she had never traveled, you know, outside the Philippines. So in those days, it was not so simple. You know, when we come to the US, we need to get a different SIM card. You cannot carry your phone. Yeah. And this was the CDMA network. We are using the GSM network, everything. So important thing I told her, Nadia, was that when I come into the airport, you have to find the closest, fastest way for me to get hold of a SIM card so I, don't, so I can get back onto online, right? And then so she comes back to me, sends me an email and said, you fly to Cathay Pacific, you land in Terminal 2, you come out, and there's an escalator on the right.
Wow.
You take the escalator up, then you go to door number 3, you catch the bus to Terminal 3. And when you come off, you take this escalator, you go up there on the second floor, make a sharp right turn, and there's this place called Joe something or other. And you can buy a CDMA card for $20. She's never traveled outside the Philippines. She's blind. And this was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
How on earth did she? I couldn't figure out how.
Could never do that.
How she do that? But the thing is that learning how the disability manifests itself is very important. Like, for example, I talked about blind people and how fast they are. They are not fast at everything. So if you send a blind person a spreadsheet which you have constructed, it takes them a long time to read that spreadsheet because they have to go to practically every cell. Then the cells, then the software reads out to them, right? Of course, if it's a spreadsheet that they know of, they know the structure, then they can quickly zero in on where to put the cursor, right? So, but if they would ask them to build a spreadsheet, they'll build one faster than I can. Because when they... Because they can, they decide what to do. This cell will do this. This cell will program this. I'll type this in. And they are faster because they have memorized all the function keys. So and we never do that. First of all, they type faster than we can. You know, in the old days, when you have what they call touch typists, you know what typists do? They don't need to look at the keyboard to type. They look at the document and type, right?
Yes,
so
yes,
so blind people can type without looking. And they are the fastest typists. Second thing is that, for example, you want to print the document, right? You click, you know, a document, then a print, then select printer, and then, you know, either 3 or 4 clicks for them is something like this, you know? 4 buttons in one go, and then just they're there already. So they're faster than you can be because they have, you know, all the function keys. So it's things like that. It's just a very small example to understand that. Don't give them a bunch of irregular spreadsheets to analyze, you know. But you want to build them build a spreadsheet. I had a blind person build me a spreadsheet with those formulas, and then, I mean, really, it's like a business plan, you know.
Document, you find where their strengths are, and you keep them where they are. That's where functionality
comes
in. It's normal.
HR person. It's a normal thing. You don't, you know, everybody has different.
This is for
some people don't have no interpersonal skills. Some people are nerds. Some people are.
Exactly.
So you put them where they can succeed.
That's right.
Well, Thomas, I note the time. We need to let you go to your next thing. You're very busy on this trip, and we really appreciate you visiting our campus. Before we wrap things up for today, I wanted to give you a chance to share with the audience how they can connect with you, find out more about your work, your business, your team, and then any final word that you would like to share with us as we wrap up.
Okay, so my website my email address is very simple. I mean, thomas@janashtim.com, and Janashtim is Genevieve, Ashley, and Timothy, so it's easy to spell.
Yeah.
I'm on LinkedIn. I'm not sure what my LinkedIn number is, but you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on WhatsApp. WhatsApp number is a Malaysian number, a bit unique why I have a Malaysian number for WhatsApp. It's a 6010-522-5098. So I think for me, I spent so many years trying to convince other companies to do that, you know, doing what we do, you can succeed as a company. It's very frustrating that it's not happening. I just wish that, this will help people open up their eyes, and you need somebody to help you. You've been so used to remote work during COVID-19, then why not provide the job to somebody in a place, in a situation where it would be very hard for that person to get a job, but he can do the work for you, right? So I think that's the and doesn't matter, you know, the person can be a refugee, can be a disabled person, can be blue, green, white, whatever. You have at your fingertips so much more resources to tap on,
yeah.
Right? So why not, do it for your own benefit?
I love it. And we didn't really even get into that, but all the benefits of remote work.
Yes.
That you just highlighted. I mean, there's so many positive benefits, but one of which is just we can literally hire anyone who's capable from anywhere in the world to do the work that needs to be done. And that's awesome. Well, Thomas, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Angela, thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Angela.
We hope everyone stays healthy and safe, that you find meaning and purpose at work each and every day. And we hope you all have a great week.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the podcast. We hope you stay healthy and safe, and please join us again soon.